With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Ruler podcast. This is the podcast for issue 49 of Ruler magazine. My name's Jack Thurston, and in case you hadn't downloaded the Ruler podcast before, the Ruler podcast is an audio accessory to Ruler magazine, which comes out 8 times a year and is a magazine that presents the finest in cycling photography reportage. Here with me to talk about this issue 49 is Andy McGrath, who's the assistant editor of the magazine.
Hi there, Jack.
Welcome back to the podcast, Andy.
Thank you.
And we should announce that we are in the new to me, offices of Ruler, which are across the river from Holborn. You have moved to Bermondsey Street, very fashionable Bermondsey Street.
That's right. We're moving south, aren't we, Sally? First we were in Old Street, now Holborn, now Bermondsey Street. So who knows where next? Croydon, maybe. Not so fashionable. But it is lovely, yeah, it's lovely here.
These are the offices, or the former offices, the top floor of the offices of the Stage magazine, which is a kind of venerable institution of thespian life in Britain, where the comings and goings in theatre land are discussed, and I think roles were advertised for and castings and that kind of thing. And I guess there's something quite appropriate about Ruler being in a theatrical magazine publishing house.
And did you come up the stairs today to get here, though? Because you have noticed all the photographs of the old stars. You've got Bruce Forsyth and Ike Turner and Tina Turner, and that makes it quite a nice walk up.
I came on the lift, I'm afraid.
All right, well, on the way down, there's some really surprising ones. Let's see who you recognise. It is fitting, yeah, it does suit us. It's a bit more spacious, I think, too.
Yeah, and a terrific rooftop view here. We're looking out towards the London Eye. We've got various cranes at work, a lot of satellite dishes, rooftop gardens and the like.
Construction going on in South London at the moment, isn't there?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of construction going on in London altogether. Let's get down to business. And the first thing we have to do in the podcast is to select a favourite photograph or photo spread from the magazine. Do you want to make the first choice, Andy?
It's always tough, this one. I might cheat and pick two. That's okay.
You can't do that.
Okay then. Okay, all right. I'll be ruthless. And I'll go for a photograph by Tim Cole in a feature called We Are Family, which is meeting a host of families and the young talents and kind of interviewing them and showing what they've given up, the sacrifices they're making to help put their child or give them a better chance of being a pro rider. And it's on, what page is it? It's 97. It's one of Gustav Hoog, the teenage Swedish rider. Because he's wrapped in the Swedish flag, and with his mum's arm and father kind of wrapped technically around him. And it just sums up the kind of, he's quite awkward in that, as you would be as a teenager, being hugged in front of the camera. And you can see the love, but also the protectiveness. And that's kind of what we were getting across a lot in the feature with a lot of the other interviewees too.
Great shot. We'll come to that feature in a minute, because you wrote the words that accompany the photographs. And I will select a kind of grisly shot. Page 142, this is a photograph of, a black and white photograph of Taylor Finney after his terrible crash. I mean, not immediately after his terrible crash, but after he's had all the rest and recuperation and surgery after his terrible crash. And He's tying up his shoelaces, and he's just got a horrible Frankenstein leg, essentially. His left leg has got two enormous scars with stitches on it. And I don't know, I think for me, this just really encapsulates the awful things that professional cyclists are prepared to deal with and have to deal with in their working lives, their sporting lives, and the willingness to come back so soon after something like that has happened to you and get back on the bike. And, you know, he's every day he's putting on his shoes and looking down, and he must see that awful mess on his legs. And I mean, it's also testament to the fact that these riders can come back so quickly from these horrible injuries and be back at the highest level in terms of athletic performance and competition, both mentally and physically. So what's the story with this photograph?
I think Taylor posted it on Twitter about 4 or 5 weeks ago. It was taken by his friend Greg Owen, who's a photographer, and we realised we really wanted this in the feature. It was a great shot, and wondered if he had any other ones. He did. He had several. I think, in fact, I probably shouldn't say this, but I believe it was taken on an iPhone, not a normal camera. But anyway, we got in touch with Greg. It took a while, and I think this is a different angle to the original on Twitter. What do you think about laces on bike shoes, by the
way?
Well,
obviously, extremely in favour of that kind of thing. I was quite surprised to see them, actually, because I thought it was all sort of Velcro straps and strange nylon buckles. Are laces back?
I think they're making a small comeback.
Really?
Yeah. Not just Giro, but I think a few other manufacturers are making them. I think it's nice. I think Bradley Wiggins favours them too, I think.
I mean, wouldn't you have to have something covering up the lace to stop it getting caught in the, you know, in a chain wheel?
They must have a way around that of manufacture. But I know what you mean. Actually, when I was much younger, I got my lace wrapped around the pedal spindle.
Yeah.
Which is what...
That's a classic.
Yeah, that's a classic. Good, we've all been there, not just me then.
All right, well, let's turn from the back of the magazine to the front of the magazine and the opening feature, which is a survey and a discussion of the art of time trialing, involving four very successful practitioners of that craft or art, as it's described in the piece. They are Steve Cummings, Taylor Finney, the aforementioned Taylor Finney, Alex Dowsett, and Michael Hutchinson. There's a lot in there. If you're interested in time trialing and you're maybe time trialing yourself, there are a few nuggets there, aren't there?
It's very easy to see good practitioners of the art of time trial, like Tony Martin or Bradley Wiggins, with the completely flat, still back, and think it's easy that it's even simple. And also the fact that most of the time, the same 3, 4, 5 riders win most of the big time trials, you'd think it's quite formulaic, but it's clear that it's not as simple as putting it into the biggest gear and smashing it for 10 miles. There's so many minute things. It's the same as climbing, sprinting, anything in cycling, maybe. I quite enjoyed finding out just about those small things. Like even at the very high end for a pro, I think Dowsett said they're thinking when they're still going extremely fast, can I change gear and get 1, 2 miles an hour more? Because that is a difference between not just first and second, first and 22nd.
I mean, it is amazing how small the margins are, because they're all off doing it individually on their own, and then the margins come down to a few seconds.
Yeah. Well, it can be heartbreaking, can't it? As one of them says, I think as soon as they cross the line and they think they've given everything and maybe they come second or third by 1 second, they'll get that nagging feeling. Could I have given more?
Michael Hutchinson, I'm quite surprised, because I get the feeling that he's a sort of scientific type of guy. He's written this book, Faster, which is a kind of exposition of his geekiness in terms of everything that he's done to go faster on the bike. But he says here, time trialing is all about feel. I'm tempted to say that anyone who relies on taking their inspiration from a 2-inch screen is not a natural time trialist.
It seems likely that these pro cyclists are probably slightly better at going into a certain zone and getting the extra 2, 3 to 5% that amateurs just cannot access, unlocking that and still being able to function. Because, you know, when I'm knackered on a bike and I've got to take a sharp corner at 25 miles an hour, I'm going to do it badly sometimes.
I remember David Miller telling me about how he would feather into the red zone
it's just embracing pain and kind of dealing with it.
Although I thought Michael again was quite interesting on pain, saying that he didn't want to refer to it as pain, and that there was a lot of machismo, which is misplaced, and actually pain is something that you use to know where you are in terms of your physical capabilities, and that they all say that they've done time trials where they've not felt that much pain and they've just been going really well.
It does strike me as a kind of the perfectionist discipline. Alex Dowsett says about the technical aspect too, that he might like his bike a certain way, but sometimes he has to cede to the team sponsors and use the equipment they have, even if it might be, you know, 5 watts slower or what have you, which is important to remember. That's quite interesting.
That was really interesting. I thought that point was really interesting, where he was saying essentially, you know, if you're an aspiring racer, don't look at what the pros are riding, because you think that that's what they've chosen to go faster, because that is actually what they've been given by their sponsor, and it wouldn't be their free choice.
That's true. I mean, just reading straight from it now, he says, you have to be adaptable. With equipment, the only say I get is the size of the bike and what type of handlebars I have, S-bends or J-bends, and whether I want a shallow or a deep front wheel. And that's it. Which I was really surprised at, actually. It's nice to have that kind of level of detail in the article. It isn't just time trialing, it's everything around it.
Well, if you go to a British time trial, you will see, I'm sure, one or two Planet X bikes, because they've been very successful at selling carbon bling to the British public at a competitive price. And I went along to meet with the Planet X folks and the boss, Dave Loughran, up in Sheffield, Rotherham Borders, and find out about one of their more recent acquisitions, which is the Holdsworth mark. And we'll come to Holdsworth in a minute, but Planet X, I thought, is an interesting story in terms of how the bike industry has changed over the years, because they're assembling bikes from parts that are manufactured in the Far East, as you know, most bike parts are nowadays. And they have attempted to cut out the distributor and retailer links in the chain and offer a bike that is essentially direct from the factory, assembled in Britain and sold via the internet, with very little overhead. And very little advertising in magazines like Ruler, which is why you might have not heard about Planet X, because they don't spend a lot of money advertising. And that, as we know, is the dark secret of a lot of cycling magazines, is that they only tend to review the marks that spend money on advertising in their mags. I think Planet X quite enjoy being the underdog, being the kind of northerners, you know, set aside from London and the cycling boom down here.
I'm reading the feature, I think not just a bit different, but outright oddballs, outcasts maybe. I think of something that Dave Loughran, who, is he the head of Planet X?
Well, he's the owner.
He's the owner, sorry.
I mean, he started the company in, you know, its earliest form while he was at home, living at home, on an enterprise allowance scheme grant, which I think got him 40 quid a week. That was, he was in a pit village in South Yorkshire, using his mum's credit card to order a dozen tri bars from America. I think he was the first person to import tri bars, and he was able to sell 11 to his mates, and that would pay for the one that he would use, because he was a keen and quite good triathlete, and he grew that business, you know, in all kinds of random directions through the late 80s and 90s, into a company that is now you know, doing 20 million. A year in sales, and it's the biggest, well, I think they're the second biggest assembler of bikes in the UK after Brompton, the folding specialists.
It's hard to believe they've done so well. I think he said something on the lines of that whenever I make something a success and it becomes slightly zeitgeisty, I move away from it and stop pushing it so hard. And so to be turning over 20 million is a real feat. He clearly has a very strong personality. I'm sure he's a very magnetic in some ways, but possibly divisive.
Yeah, I think quite,
as you say, it's
quite
probably
difficult
the word to use.
Difficult guy to work for, but also very charismatic leader as well. And so, yeah, the extensive reason for my visit was the acquisition of the Holdsworth mark, which is a venerable old name in British bike making, a name that had sort of somehow lost its way. Obviously, its original owners sold it on and sold it on, and then it got sold on again, and it just became a kind of mark with a heritage and a history and nothing really to say for itself in the present day, but a huge amount of affection for the brand, in its, particularly in its iteration in the late 60s and 70s in the Holdsworth Campagnolo team. And I spoke to Jamie Burrow, who is a former pro with US Postal Service, now working for Planetex, and he's their man in Italy. And I asked him to explain how Holdsworth slotted into the Planet X strategy.
We bought the brand at the back end of last year. And obviously, I think Holdsworth as a brand had failed where they couldn't keep up with the pace of modern things. You know, they failed with the carbon, etc. So as soon as we bought the brand, I was given it as a project. And to me, Holdsworth meant retro, the retro steel style. You know, that's what they were famous for, from kind of like the 30s through to the 80s, like, you know, with the pinnacle being the professional Campag. So we set about kind of going through all the back catalogues and picking out kind of the iconic frames from the different periods from the 40s through to the 80s. For us, Holdsworth should be steel, and it should be handmade in Britain, hand-painted in Britain, and as much as British as possible. Our first samples we've had handmade in Italy, you know, by the best guys in the business. But if we can get the volume, the plan is to bring everything back to the UK. I mean, obviously, Planet X being based in Sheffield, if we can have steel frames made in a steel city, that would be perfect. And we purposely went down to Reynolds in Birmingham. We wanted Reynolds involved, and for me, when designing this first range, I wanted everything Fire-3-1, obviously, except for the Italia, which is obviously Columbus. I said it needs to be Fire-3-1 just because the Fire-3-1 badge is iconic to the Holdsworth badge. And they're obviously, they don't produce Fire-3-1 anymore, but they've got a brilliant catalogue of new tubes, and they have tubing with the same properties we needed and the same diameters. And I said, no, it just doesn't fit unless it has the Fire-3-1 badge. And they've been really good in actually remaking Fire-3-1 just for us.
But Planet X is famous for its modern bicycles. That seems like quite a departure for you as a company.
Well, we bought, along with Holdsworth, back in the last year, we also bought Vino. It's kind of second-tier Italian brand. And they were very famous for offering custom-made carbon frames that didn't have quite the price tag of a Pinarello or a Coronago. In the beginning, they were kind of all side projects. Yet, as a Planet X family, the way we see things, with Planet X, we've got your kind of 799 bikes up to maybe like £1,600-1,600, covering entry-level and medium race bikes. Whereas we could put the same amount of effort into these bikes for the lovely worked lugs and the chrome finishes, but if you put a Planet X brand on it, it just doesn't really do it justice. So now, as a family, we can have beautiful classic handmade steel with Holdsworth. We can have your entry through to mid-range with Planet X, and then have beautiful handmade top-end race bikes with the Vina brand, and then obviously on one for your mountain bike at Urban. And in one house, we've covered pretty much everything, all the different aspects of cycling.
That was Jamie Burrow talking about how Holdsworth is going to be a part of Planet X. It is a very strange departure, and it is a classic Dave Loughran move that doesn't really make any commercial sense, but maybe through the sheer force of his personality and his kind of nose for a bargain, it will work out. I mean, subsequent to doing the interview and the visit, he said that he'd made an agreement with an Italian bike making factory that they were going to export everything to Britain and set up in Rotherham. I don't know if that's actually going to happen, but that seemed to be agreed in principle, that they were going to bring production to Britain for these bikes.
That's a big departure as well, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that brings me to a short interview I did with Lorenzo Altissimo, who worked in the tubing business in Italy for 20 years for Columbus and Dedicai. And Lorenzo is handling the sort of steel side of things. I was interested in his take on the future of steel bikes. And I asked him how steel bikes were faring in the Italian market.
Almost disappeared. In Italy, it's a really good market for the high-end products. And aluminium first and carbon afterwards has killed the steel completely. In Italy, I would say not even the big firm like De Rosa or Pinarello or Colnago as well are selling a lot in Italy still. The culture has completely disappeared, and I don't know the reason why. I believe because the Italian market for the high-end and really high-end products is very good, and that's why the people have switched immediately to aluminium when it came in the market, and then carbon. In the UK, it's pretty different. People is much more attached to the culture, to the past culture. And again, once more, not only today, but even in my past job, I've seen much more attachment to the steel.
And so what's happened to the places and the factories and the people who actually make it? Has that disappeared or is that still there?
In Italy, they're still working, not very much, but there's still some good frame makers, there's still some good painters, because Italy is still anyway exporting very much. You know, that's the main reason why they're still working. For the Italian market itself, they would be already closed.
So what are the markets internationally? Which countries?
Oh, there's a... I'm talking about, of course, the big name like De Rosa, Pinarello, Colnago. They sell a lot in the Far East. They sell a lot here in the UK, in the USA. Taiwan is getting a really good market. Japan always been a really good market for that. So those are the main markets where they're still surviving, produced in Italy.
That was Lorenzo Altissimo talking about how steel is dead in Italy, at least for the Italian markets, yeah. And that they do have a steel bike-making industry still there, but it's entirely serving export customers, principally in markets like Britain, America, and the Far East.
How can they revive it?
I don't think they can.
No.
I mean, I think that romance is just not there. Maybe because it's too close to home, it's too mundane, or maybe it's because the interest in cycling is from a performance perspective in Italy, and you've got people who want to maybe become a racer, and young people who want to have the fastest bike, and then you've got the older guys who, you know, just want every little bit of help that they can get in keeping the wheels turning, because you do see some kind of rather portly old Italian gentlemen who I dare say were good riders in their youth, but you know, on quite carrying quite a lot of weight on these extremely lightweight carbon bikes. It does seem as though a lot of the skill and expertise in custom steel bike manufacturing in Italy is being transferred into custom carbon bike manufacturing in Italy.
Yeah.
And there have been features in Ruler in the past on that, about how, because we assume that carbon bikes are kind of made out of a mold and pressed and inflated and cooked and all that kind of thing in a Far East, which, you know, is true for most of them. But there is this sort of lugged tube cutting equivalent version, which is much more expensive and much more custom, that still goes on.
It's always going to be the economic viability of making the majority of frames in Asia or in Taiwan. It's always going to be favoured by the majority of brands. It's just, it would be really nice for Holdsworth to get a foothold back in the market.
I mean,
they're a great brand.
Yeah, they are a great brand.
With a great history.
They are a great brand with a great history, but they're not going to be they're not going to be cheap bikes. If you're having a steel bike made, there are a ton of small boutique frame builders who will do something really interesting and really unusual for you. And what they're talking about with Holdsworth is still very much a production range. It's, you know, off the peg stuff. And there are a lot of old steel bike frames out there. If you're interested in that vintage look, you know, why would you have a 531 bike frame made now when you can get one for a fraction of the price that was made 30 years ago? If that's what you're interested in a bike, and maybe has a bit of history.
And of course, as you mentioned in the article, I think, how are Planet X going to deal with selling a much pricier model when they're used to, I think their £1,000 frame is by far the best seller. I've seen it in bike shops everywhere, time trials, road races, sportives. That's going to be the next challenge. But
yeah, I mean, that's the truth. And when I talked about how Planet X has grown, that growth has entirely come, well, not entirely, but largely come from the £1,000 carbon road bike with a Altegra group set, which is just a phenomenal price, you know, to produce that spec, and is irresistible in the market. But it's difficult to see how a single company can offer best value for money and best that money can buy, because they're two very different things. But I do like what Planet X are doing, because I think there are some huge margins in the bike industry, and whether they're huge profit margins or they're just huge margins that get spent on lots of advertising, lots of promotion and marketing and brand development and that kind of thing. I like the idea that there is an option if you don't want to be buying into a, you know, very, very aspirational high margin product. You can still get something that is good, and clearly the Planet X bikes are being ridden very fast. There are plenty of people out there winning races on Planet X bikes.
Well, you just have a look around the factory, as you did, and you've got Mark Lovett working there, Jamie Burrows working there. I mean, you've got some of the fastest British racers of generation. I'm sure I'm forgetting several other names who have all ridden.
John Tanner.
The bikes, yeah. Raiden, the late Raiden. So they're not just cheap, they're fast as well. So it's perfect in a way.
We shall see how they go. Yeah. Let's talk about your piece, Andy, on family. We mentioned it at the beginning. And this kind of dovetails quite nicely with a piece in the last issue that I talked about in the podcast with Tom Southam about the sacrifices that families make, or in that case that partners make, of their professional cycling husband or wife. Where did the idea come from for doing this piece?
I think it was a one from Tim Cohen. He had the idea and got in touch with me. I think I was on the tour of Britain and said I need someone to come next week to do this feature. But I was sold on it because it is something that I'd never seen before. The family are always in the background, not just in cycling, but in kind of any sport, any profession. They're always there to pick up the pieces if the race goes badly or celebrate if it goes well. And they're quite easily somehow erased from the sport. You have the mechanic, the soigneur, the coach. There's not a great consideration made for the family. In fact, it's not in the piece, but and it was going to be. I took it out because there wasn't much space for an intro. There was a French father during the junior race who was remonstrating with one of the heavies who kind of guard the people with accreditation from the hoi polloi without. And his son, Frank Bonnemore, was on the attack in a junior road race, and it looked like he was going to win. And I could hear him shouting, "My boy is going to win, my boy is going to win, let me through, you have to let me through." He was really angry. He was quite a small man, and his bounce was quite wide, so he wasn't going to do anything. Okay, in the end, his son was caught and didn't win, but I thought that was quite an evocative image. That must be so frustrating. Kind of the biggest moment of his career, possibly, and you can't even get to see the screen or the finish line to possibly share it with him.
I mean, did you get a sense for how much families have to contribute to the sporting lives of their offspring if they're successful? I mean, it's because cycling is one of those sports where there's quite a lot. I mean, there's quite a lot of expense in all the kit.
Yeah.
Races are all over the country, so it's not like if you're playing football where, you know, you turn up and you play at your home ground, or, you know, everyone goes in a coach with a team off to play elsewhere. People do have to do a lot of driving, give up a lot of time, a lot of petrol miles. It's expensive in time and money to have a cycling offspring, isn't it?
It is. You do get a sense of that. A lot of these parents are quite self-effacing, and doing the interviews in front of their offsprings, they don't want to push it too much. So I think the Swedish family, for example, said they'd driven 20,000 kilometres that year in support of their son, Gustav. But it is always there. And it isn't just a fact talking to the parents. It's also, we wanted it to mainly be juniors on the cusp of becoming stars and pros, to kind of grasp the uncertain period. Because it isn't just the parents that could change if they become successful. It's a rider that could change. And it's kind of asking the question, what happens when your son becomes a star and becomes the property of agents, sponsors, hundreds of requests every year, which is what has happened to Nairo Quintana, the winner of the Giro, who is the last interviewee with his father and mother. And that was quite a humbling experience, actually, because we'd talked to 14 families in that week in Florence, and about 8 have made it into the feature. But he just spoke very simply but powerfully about the bond of family and said it was like sowing the earth. I believe they run a farm in Boyaca, actually. I'm not sure how you say that. To be honest, I was a little bit choked at the end, and because I wasn't expecting that at all. I mean, it took Quintana's family, possibly from Colombia, just to realise the most basic principles and to speak about it eloquently.
Do you think that there are potential bike racers who haven't been able to progress because they haven't had the family support? Is it something that is essential, or can you make it without having the family who's prepared to drop everything to, you know, run around the country with you and spend money on your stuff?
It's a good question. I think at least there needs to be the initial willingness, and then maybe to pass them on to a cycling club or a coach or something like that. And the mix here is that you have some parents too who are ex-racers who have been in cycling and know it inside out, like Seamus Downey. And you had one American family, the Mostovs, who had no idea. And they weren't afraid to say so, which is what I really liked, because it would be easy to pretend you know it all. But even then they were saying, we're still learning every day about cycling. And
is cycling the kind of sport where you can have problems with pushy parents?
None of them want to say it, and none of the parents would ever admit they're pushy parents. So it is down to me to look and see the small things they're doing, like telling the rider that he should be resting and not doing this interview anymore, or watching from the kind of bylines and seeing how they react when the rider finishes. There are definitely a fair few. I think you wouldn't see it at a world championships so much as at a local race, perhaps with riders on a lower level who haven't made it, because most of these families were so proud, as you would be. And the world championships is something that any family who are into cycling or not can understand. I mean, you're representing your country. It's a very simple thing.
Yeah, and also by the time you're there, you're pretty good. The worst case is the sort of parent who won't accept their child for either lack of talent physically, or they just don't have the desire or inclination for cycling, but can't kind of accept that. And just sort of, it does bring you back to Philip Larkin, doesn't it? they fuck you up, your mum and dad.
Exactly.
Can we say that in the podcast? Well, I just did. We ought to just do a quick roundup of what else is in the issue, if you've not got it in front of you. The usual columns from Matt Seaton, Johnny Green, and a great time trialing recollection from Robert Miller. Taylor Finney interviewed by Ian Cleverly, and what else? And with the Tour of Britain in mind, you've unearthed a lost canister of cinefilm footage of the Milk Race 1966 as it travelled through Wales, and you've got some still images from that cinefilm, and the fascinating story about how the guy who photographed this race in colour, I should hasten to add, because there's not an awful lot of colour film of British cycling in the 1960s, about the story about how that came about, which is a caper across the mountains of Wales in the mid 60s. And finally, let's mention the profile of an appreciation of Daniel Mongia, the voice, the speaker of the Tour de France for 41 years. And this is a piece by Edward Pickering, who's one of my favourite writers in cycling. Is this his debut for Ruler?
I believe it is, yeah.
Yeah, I think right. It is. That's good. Right. I think there's other stuff he's doing as well, isn't there, in the pipeline?
There's something in the pipeline for issue 50, yeah. But we'll keep that quiet. But let's just say it's definitely worth waiting for.
Yeah. So a brilliant appreciation of Daniel Mongia, who is a voice that is inseparable from the Tour de France. And let's play out on this issue's podcast with what you can't get from the magazine, because Edward does his best to describe the voice of Daniel Mongia, but this being the Ruler podcast, we give you Daniel Mongia. Thanks for listening. I'm Jack Thurston.
And I'm Andy McGrath.
Until next time, goodbye.
Ils vont passer dans un court moment, donc sous le portique vite, l'officiel du Tour de France qui annonce le dernier kilomètre, mais quelle image! Le champion du monde et le numéro un mondial en tête de peloton, un peloton très étiré. On aperçoit également Johnny Hoegerland, le héros malheureux de ce Tour de France, en première place Bernard Teisel, qui a pris la tête maintenant. Ils sont sous le portique. Vittel, l'officiel du Tour, moins d'un kilomètre. Bernard Teisel qui emmène Marc Cavendish. Il est en bonne position. On aperçoit également les autres sprinters avec Touruzod qu'il se replace, il reste 800 mètres à couvrir. L'équipage Tessai Rode va-t-elle permettre à Marc Cavendish d'obtenir une troisième victoire consécutive sur les Champs-Élysées? Il est là en cinquième position.
André Greipel est en première place. José Joaquim Rojas, le sprinter espagnol. Et là également, on retrouve, dans quelques heures, on retrouve d'autres sprinters. Et dans quelques secondes, nous connaîtrons donc le vainqueur de l'étape du jour. Quel va être le plus rapide sur l'avenue des Champs-Élysées? On retrouve tous les sprinters, l'équipe HTC Aeroad avec Cavendish qui va déboîter dans un instant le grand britannique qui attaque en tête. Elle va voir son agami qui tente de passer. Elle va voir son agami Cavendish. Et le plus rapide, elle va de Bassonagon.
Thanks for downloading this edition of the Ruler podcast. You can read Ruler magazine, which comes out 8 times a year, by taking out a subscription. Go to www.ruler.cc, or you can pick up the latest edition at a growing number of bookshops and bike shops. If you've got an iPad, you can read the magazine on the iPad. Not only the current issue, but a handful of back issues as well. You'll find it in the Apple Bookstore.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.